This is Pete Fornatale back on the Crawdaddy Rock Review, and my special guest this segment is David Brenner, one of the best-known comedians working in America today. Are you known equally as well outside of America, David?
Guam. A lot of fans in Guam. And they throw fish at you. I hate going there. That's how they show their appreciation for acts.
Well, then you should be complimented by it, I trust. You haven't recorded, have you?
No. I'm going to do it now. My first selection is a tune written, it was by Wayne Newton. No, I haven't recorded. I'll tell you why I haven't recorded. Okay. There are several reasons why, if you're really interested.
I really would
the
like
The reason
to.
I have not done a comedy record album is because, or as they say in the West Coast, a record product, is because I think that in a lot of ways, the comedy albums are ripoffs. In other words, let's say I did David Brenner live at the so-and-so club or in concert. I mean, why don't people just wait and I'll be in their town and they can see me live in concert? It's a shame. That's one of the thoughts. And thank goodness I don't need the money so badly that I have to do an album. The other reason is I always thought if I do an album, I'd like to do something really different. I don't want to just do my act. I like to do something different. I have not been able to think of something different that is acceptable to the record industry. I thought of things that are different, but they're not acceptable.
So. What might not be acceptable?
Well, I was thinking of doing one. This may be too expensive. I was thinking of doing one. I'm really going back to Philadelphia, where I'm from, and doing it with music, sound effects, the whole thing, and talk about the routines that I do about Philadelphia and home and the guys and all, but actually intersperse it with conversations with the real characters that are there in the streets and the sounds of the city. You know, and that kind of thing. I think something like that was done years ago by a comedian, I forget his name. I thought of that idea. I really haven't spent that much time thinking of record ideas.
Let me trip you up a little bit and ask you if there are any records by comics that you are glad were preserved on that moment 10 years ago or 5 years ago for people to have today.
Well, I'll tell you something. I would like to get Steve Martin's album because I'm a big fan of his, you know, just for that reason. My friends have sent me their albums. And I hate to say this, I've never even taken them out of the plastic, let alone listened to them. I've never listened to a comedy album. I don't know why, and I shouldn't be saying this, but for me, you hear it once, and you've got to really be either dedicated or very sick to listen to the second time. I mean, the joke is going to be there the same. I mean, with music, you put on something, you know, you put on one Elton John, you can hear it during its popularity 150 times, and then within the next 2 years, hear it another 50 times. That's 200 times you've heard Elton John, and you're still digging him. You tell me one joke that you can hear 200 times. I never wrote one that you could hear 200 times.
I guess their purpose is more as a document then. For example, the obvious one is Lenny Bruce. It's good to have a record of what he was into when he was doing it.
I think that's very good if you are trying to record something for posterity. Personally, when the great MC in the sky rips me off this stage, I really don't care if there's anything left of me except the memory and the people who are still here.
Selfish, David. We want
totally
those.
Totally selfish.
We want those routines.
But I do not throw garbage in the East River. So I do care about the future.
Well, that sort of balances things out then.
Gives me my altruistic side.
You mentioned Steve Martin before in the context of your being a fan. Is it really possible for you to enjoy another's work without a sense of competition entering into it?
We're very lucky comedians. We can afford to be nice people, and I'll tell you why. There are approximately 215 million people living in this country, right? Out of the 215 million, I don't think there are more than 60 comedians that anyone can name who's in or out of the business. I mean earning comedians that make their living totally, and good livings by comedy. 60 people out of 215 million, we can afford to be nice to each other.
Who are some of the others that you enjoy and who have influenced you, if that's the case?
Well, I don't think the only influence I ever had was my father. He's the funniest man in the world, and that's really, he was a vaudeville comedian, and he's great. He's a banana. It's Sick City with him. And that's the influence. It's his timing and delivery that I have. So that's the only influence that I'm aware of. However, as far as enjoying another comedian, I watched The Tonight Show. George Burns was on. And with Frank Sinatra and George Burns. I mean, he just had me screaming. I can watch the most subtle comedian and laugh the most outrageously obvious comedian in Laugh. There are very few comedians. I am a super audience. I should be hiring myself out as audience. I should be front table at all clubs. That's how much I enjoy comedy.
You can hire out, I suppose. They might be a living in that.
Yes, I mean, if they want me, I'll do an impression of the front row. I'll wear white socks, brown shoes, a blue suit. I'll do the number. I'll have a badge. Hello, my name is. I'll do the whole number. But
were you a funny kid?
I was hysterical. I was outrageously hysterical.
Other
from
people,
age two.
Other people thought that.
I mean, I never listened to other people. Yes. Every teacher who expelled me, I think in the pure conscience of their souls, knew that I was funny, not destructive. I was always funny. I've been funny since then, but I'm also serious, but I've been funny. I mean, I'm just sitting here naked because it's warm out. I have always been funny because I enjoy humor.
I see. Well, when did this manifest itself into thoughts of a profession?
Now, this is maybe the funniest thing I ever said. I didn't want to be a comedian.
Now, cut that out.
No, I didn't want to be a comedian. I was a writer, producer, film director, primarily documentaries and television, now, and did a lot of other kind of productions, tape and live and talk shows and variety shows and music specials and hard exposés and so forth and so on. I had it with that. It was wonderful. I loved it. Great, great career, but that's enough, you know, I did it. So I took an interim period of 1 year after sitting on a beach in the West Indies by myself for 15 days, which will show you what can happen to you on a beach alone in the West Indies for 15 days.
For sure.
I said, comedy. Why don't I goof off for a year in New York, hang out in the village, the West Side, boom, boom, out in Sheepshead Bay, goof off as a comedian for a year, and during this time, decide what I want to do. The end of the year came. I was having a lot of fun, and I thought, I'm not going to walk out of here without leaving something to myself to prove that I did this. In other words, I thought, wouldn't it be great to get on a Tonight Show? And one day down the line, you're talking to people, and they say, I was a comedian. What comedian? Yeah, I was a professional comedian for a year. Come on. Oh, yeah? Push button. Bzz, film rolls. And there I am. Dun, 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 dun. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen, making his debut on television. New comedian, David Brenner. So I thought, I got to get on television. I'm going to do a Tonight Show and get a kinescope. And I did the Tonight Show. Well, I didn't know the power. I had heard about it, but I didn't realize the power of that one appearance on that program. Ba-room. Next thing I know, $10,000 worth of job offers within the next 24 hours and a career. I said, hey, man, I'm on to something. I happen to like what I'm doing, but this can really be lucrative because I was starving up until then.
What's the first thing you said? Do you remember your first line?
I said, I was driving in New Jersey. I always get lost in New Jersey. The whole state looks the same to me. I think they have 7 people and 9 trees. They just keep moving it down the road. That was the first thing I said. Yeah. And it got a laugh, and I was on my way for the next 8.5 minutes. If I were to sit down and type a script and describe the best thing that could happen to a comedian in his debut on television, I would have left out some of the great things that happened that night. That's how good it was.
That's great.
Yeah.
And that moment really did make for your career.
Launched the whole career.
David, let's stop here and we'll continue after this break. This is Pete Fornital on the Crawdaddy Rock Review with David Brenner. Let's continue. You kept getting asked back to The Tonight Show. Did you have the material? I mean, here you go. You could have a career on the club circuit with the same piece of material for a long time. You do it once on Griffin and it's out there.
All right, I'll tell you. It is fortunate for comedians, some comedians today, who are not nameless, but let's call them nameless, can have 45 minutes, an hour's worth of material, and make a fortune and travel around with the same and keep going on television and do things like this. I've gotten a lot of requests lately to do my shoe in the ear routine. And then he does the shoe in the ear. The next time you see him, he says, you know, it's funny, I was going to come out here tonight, I was going to tell you about my mother and her washing machine, but a guy backstage said, hey, you know what a routine I love? That shoe in the ear. So I'm going to do the shoe. And you hear the shoe in the ear until you have the shoe in the ear coming out of your ear. But they have wonderful careers and they're stars, okay? For some personal pride, I guess, and now professional pride, my first 3 years on The Tonight Show, I didn't repeat one joke. Now, I have just done my 77th appearance on The Tonight Show, which has consumed 6 hours of original material. And I'm busting myself to come up with the next new lines and the next new ideas. I think that it may pay off for me. I don't know. I may last longer because people who tune in say, oh, that's new. I heard that one, but that's new.
Yeah.
So maybe I can last a little longer. Plus, I don't want to do the same thing on television. Take that 45 minutes, go out on the road, do the same 45 minutes, rip the people that way, because you're ripping them.
Can I tell you someone who I felt was ruined by television's voracious appetite? Jackie Vernon. Funny
hysterical
comic. His routines about the slide projector, the imaginary
slide projector.
They just became so overseen, I suppose.
Well, the television...
That he's virtually disappeared, and that's a shame.
Television, yeah, he's brilliantly funny. Television can eat you up. I mean, I learned a lot, like Rodney Dangerfield and I used to pal around. There was a guy that I think to this day is the funniest comedy writer in the business. I mean, classic lines that are gems. Leaving the apartment, he left the radio on, all the lights on, and a big note. I left a note on the door. I'm home. I came home a few hours later, and under my note was another note. We looked all over for it. Freddie gets robbed. Now, that's classic humor. You know, you got to come up with something new. You know, keep doing new. And he I just saw him a few weeks ago. Always new. And a lot of other comedians. I mean, Cosby's been, what, a star, a superstar, 14 years?
Sure.
You go to see him, and you'll see a whole new act. And even the so-called hip underground guys like Lenny Bruce. I mean, come on. Lenny was, he would say himself, he was a comedian. I don't think he was leading any great cause. He was trying to get a job. He was trying to get his career back, and he fought it, and he was right. But he was always coming up with new stuff, stream of consciousness on the stage. I think it's important. If I do it for myself, man. If the audience is, I don't care. Brenner could do the same things. It's all right with me. I don't care about if that's what they think. It's a pride. I like to come up with something new that's funny. I don't want to stop with the same painting and keep running around town with it.
David, there are comedians today who appeal to a specific audience. You've got your youth
oriented. You mind if I at least put on my shoes now?
Please.
Okay, go ahead.
The Cheech and Chong, George Carlin types. Yeah. And then there are those who strictly play for a specific ethnic group or adult audience. You cross lines.
Yeah, all of them, yeah.
What is the secret to that?
I don't know. I started out doing very hip, bright, social commentary material. Now, I'll tell you what I learned from it. When I first started, before television,
okay. The
political stuff and social, I found out something, an interesting thing, which may be a commentary on the whole scene anyway. I sat in the fence, like I did as a documentarian. Now, remember, I made the change from documentary to comedy overnight,
right,
except for the 15 days on Nevis in the island. And it's a tough transition. I sat in the fence comedically. Now, I would poke sides at the liberal point of view on issues and people, and the conservative. And I found out something very interesting. When you made fun of the liberal point of view, the whole audience laughed. When you made fun of the conservative point of view, only the liberals laughed. So every other line, you were losing half a house.
And I said,
if you get into an area where it's heavy conservative, you're not going to get many laughs. And I figured, why am I out to make only a certain segment laugh?
My thought is that, very much like a Bill Cosby, you are one of those people who can zero in on foibles that are common to us all. And I will tell you the classic David Brenner line for me. You spoke of having worked in an amusement park once.
That's a true story. That was me.
Who has to stand there. And hear that same line over and over again that every parent who brings their kid on the ride says, which is,
here we go. 3 years of here we go.
Well, damned if I didn't take a friend of mine to an amusement park very shortly after having heard you do that. And sure enough, the family right in front of us.
Here we go.
And we laughed. And how do you explain it? You know?
I don't know. But you know what's interesting, see, is that a young hip guy like yourself could be sitting behind there.
I just checked it.
You don't mind if I put my socks on over my shoes, right? A young hip guy can be sitting there behind that couple, like yourself, and laugh, recalling what I said on television about the Woodside Amusement Park. A 70-year-old woman with her husband, whether he is alive or belated, can be sitting there and laugh too. So I have reached you and I have reached her. Why? Because of one thing. It's funny. You see, it's funny.
There it is. Sure.
That's what it is. I don't know why it's funny, but it's funny. And I'll tell you something. It wasn't funny to me then when it was happening, but that's why it's funny to me now.
Right. My real last question is about...
This is the last question now.
This is it. Well, maybe.
All right, because I'm going to put on my shorts if this is the last one.
We'll see then.
All right.
Snip was a series starring yourself that was promised for the season before last.
Yeah, a year ago.
A promise that was never delivered on.
A promise that was kept until 1 week before airtime.
What happened?
I don't know what happened. I'll tell you, maybe I should preface this by saying the door at NBC, as they say, is always open to me if I want to do a series. So, you know, I'm not going to pick on the network, and I'm not saying that the network came down on me. Snip was a show which had major problems from the beginning. But it was a show at the end of which, in that short period of seven shows that we did, four of which are hysterically funny, three of which are very funny. So much so that one show we cut 6 minutes of laughter out in order to bring it down to the time limit. Another one, and we had to do something like that to another one. No joke told in front of the live audience needed laugh track. That's unusual. However, the network did say that the shows were too, and this is their quote, because I read it in the trades, because I didn't care, I just took off after it was over, offbeat, which they may be right. However, I only challenged that a little bit and took great solace. Matter of fact, I considered a compliment in another aspect. The industry, the so-called, quote, industry, unquote, okay, that runs my field, my business, has always said, upon seeing me as an individual performer, he's never going to make it, he's too offbeat. Now, they were definitely wrong about me as an individual performer.
Right.
They may not have been wrong about the show, or they may have been. The idea was, I learned a lot from it, it was very good, and at the end of it, I just went back on the road, which I enjoyed anyway. I was living in Los Angeles out there. If I saw one more Gucci shoe, I would have thrown up, and a Gucci bracelet, and all the machines that are wound up and let go, and it just wasn't my kind of life. That's why, you know, I live in New York, so I was glad to get on the road and back to the city.
But David, my mother, the car, was offbeat.
It was not. Now, we know what we're dealing with.
Let's stop here. We'll continue with David Brenner right after this message. This is Pete Fornital on the Crawdaddy Rock Review with our guest, David Brenner. Now for my real last question.
Okay, this is the last one. Why am I wearing three ties on my bare chest? I will not answer that question.
It's not it.
I'll tell you about two of them.
You were helpful, or one of the people helpful in the career of Freddie Prinze.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended so tragically, and it was a tragedy shared by the nation for what he had given in terms of laughter and performance. That says something about your business. It says something about the arena in which you operate, that there are pressures there and problems there that could lead to such an eventuality.
I often wonder, you know, I've thought a lot about it since it happened, of course. You know, I was with Freddie the three nights previous to the night he did it. I was with him Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday in California, and I flew to Florida on Thursday, and Thursday night he did it. I must have tossed this around in my head, I don't know how many thousands of times, about Freddie. He's always on my mind, you know, and everything. And we were very close. And we were more than just comedian friends. We were, I guess Freddie was the closest thing I ever had to a younger brother, you know. And I often thought about it, and I kind of wondered in the thought if Freddie being what he was and how he was, if he had not gone into our business, if Freddie had, somehow I feel Freddie had been a dentist, he might have done the same thing, but further along in his life. In other words, I think the seed was there, and I think that the show business gave him the fertile soil around which that seed sprung so, you know, out of the ground so quickly and grew so ferociously that no one could cut it down. Freddie and I rapped about it. I mean, Freddie talked about this. I mean, it isn't something he did that came from the blue. I didn't know how close he was or anything when I was out. I didn't know. Freddie and I saw each other when I was in Los Angeles or he came to New York. But Freddie and I, he always showed me the good side. And he was smart, you know. Freddie never let on to the people he knew would stop him. You got to remember that. Freddie let on, let everyone know who he knew deep down inside would do nothing to stop him or didn't have the capability of stopping him or would be too late in trying to stop him. I mean, if he would have clued, someone once asked me, well, what would you have done? I said, let me tell you, as any position of dealing with Freddie, whether it be professionally or as his friend, and I heard talk like that or heard that he did the things that you're telling me now that he did with revolvers, putting them up to his head and all that kind of stuff, I would have taken him to an island, roped him, nailed him to the beach for 2 weeks, and gotten him professional help. I don't care if he was underage. As his friend, I would have done this. But of course, you got to remember, I'm not into Freddie for a percent of his business.
Right.
I got from Freddie his friendship, which is 100%. When I got my first job in television, not comedy, I had 80 cents. And when I say 80 cents, I don't mean I had 80 cents in my pocket and $400 in the bank. I didn't even have a savings account. I never had a savings account. Only as a kid in school, they forced you to save a quarter, you know what I mean? All right, which I blew on some bad plays later on after high school. But anyway, it was only $100, didn't matter. Now, I had 80 cents when I got that job. Now, I put the 80 cents, and I was living in an apartment, and there were what's known, I think they're called whitefish. They're little bugs. I mean, if they had grown into people, I could have populated a country. It was an apartment where the elevated line ran in front of the bedroom window, so every time it passed, things shook. If they passed during the rush hour and happened to coincide in front, you could lose your window and all your fillings. This is what I was living in, all right? I got the job in television first. Took the 80 cents, I had an old rag there, ripped up, it was like an old t-shirt that I used to clean my shoes. Took it, ripped it up, rolled it up, you know, tied a knot in it, the 80 cents, 3/4 and a nickel. I threw it in the drawer. I said, you know, someday I'm going to get that frame and on top of black velvet and a sterling silver frame with a little placard underneath it called, and written on the placard will be, lest we forget. So that if I ever become something in my life and think I'm a big deal, I'll be able to look on that shelf and see that 80 cents and remember what I came from. And what I lived in most of my life, which is still most of, more of my life than the high flying I'm doing now, well, that sits on a shelf today in my den in my apartment here. But it's always been in my head. The problem was Freddie, coming from the same environment, didn't have that 80 cents in his head, and he just couldn't hold on to the handle. He said something once. He said, "Even my friends are according to my ratings."
Wow.
That's a pretty sad commentary on that life and the business out there. And I think that if Freddie, and I truly believe this, and I go to visit Freddie whenever I'm in California now, you know, I stop by. I think that if Freddie could say anything to any of us now, he would say, man, I'm sorry I did that. I blew it, man, you know. I blew it. And I think that's what Freddie was all about. I think what Freddie is about today is I think that I would hope that people would do what I try. I have a tough time doing it, being a friend. But I really do. I think that Freddie today would like to be thought of not for how he died, you know what I mean? But for that short little burst of light, you know, that he had when he really made us laugh. He was so young. And so damn talented.
David, thank you for commenting on
that. Hey, my pleasure. Can I put on the rest of my clothes?
My real last question.
Yes.
You're the first comedian we've had on the Crawdaddy Rock Review.
Yeah.
Every musical act, I ask them if they have a favorite cut on their new album. Do you have a favorite joke, a favorite line that works for you every time, Old Faithful?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's in Portuguese, but I'll do it for you anyway. No. I think the line that seems, the routine that seems to still be the most called for, which I don't do anymore because it needs a certain environment, is I do this routine about getting rid of the perfect murder, how to get rid of a dead body in New York. You just slip it into the crowd. And then I become the dead body for a week as I go through Radio City and get killed by cars a few times. You know, that is a very tough routine physically to do. But I think the joke that people seem to call out the most for and remember the most is the story that I tell, which really is a story that you can understand could happen, and if you know, and it does happen to people, of the dumb things we say, of sitting on a subway. And I'm sitting on a newspaper, and a man comes over, and he says, "Are you reading that?" And the first time, it happened to me twice, which is true. First time it happened, I just stared at the guy. I mean, this is a lunatic. The second time it happened, I was ready for it. And I stood up, turned the page, sat down. So this, saying yes, I did that.
David, all good things to you in your career. Now, will you get your clothes out and get out of here?
Where's my helmet?
The end.
You've been listening to the Crawdaddy Rock Review, a copyrighted feature produced by Cinema Sound Limited in association with the editors of Crawdaddy Magazine and presented by Discwasher, makers of Ultimate Record Care Equipment. Production techniques and engineering by Martin Brooks, direction by Len Dugo. Tune in again next time. This is Pete Fornital.